Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. This week, we are presenting a special series of speakers from the 2017 Camden Conference. Now in its 27th year, the Camden Conference convenes annually to bring a variety of diplomats, professors, journalists, and policy officials to address a topic of international, political, and humanitarian significance. This year's conference, Refugees and Global Migration, Humanity's Crisis, features speakers exploring the varied causes of the current international crisis and the challenges that come with accepting immigrants from particular countries, regions, and demographic groups. Today, we bring you the keynote address for the conference from Paul James, director and professor of the Institute for Culture and Study at Western Sydney University in Australia. He also serves as research director of Global Reconciliation, an international organization based in Australia that has been bringing people together in an ongoing dialogue in global zones of conflict, including Sri Lanka and the Middle East. For more information and the full roster of speakers in the Camden Conference, visit their website, camdenconference.org. Here's Paul James.
We have here a lot of major issues, and I think we are talking about a humanitarian crisis, a crisis of humanity. And we're doing so in a way that tries to come to terms with it in ways that are very rarely given the depth of time to do so. Some facts and figures help, but it's also the question of what we're going to do about it. If I can give you just one fact to start with, of those people who arrive by boat, one in four dies. That boy died. He was a boy that became the subject of headlines. His brother died, his mother died. And it was the beginnings of a process of seeing what had been going on for years and years. So I'm going to start talking about that process where we're actually trying to set up the conditions of blaming the victim as an attempt to say that somehow what needs to be done is that they shouldn't die. We actually blame them for the process, for their moving, for their choosing leaky boats, and we blame them for coming here, and then we say, like Lawrence Lockman says, that somehow they won't come if they're given more, less resources. If we held those resources back from them, they would stay in place. And I think that's one of the most facile things I've ever heard from any politician recently. It's the kind of thing which leads you to a misunderstanding of the complexity of the human crisis we're facing. 9.5 Syrian displaced people. I say that carefully and precisely because displaced people are not the same as refugees. It's defined by the United Nations that you have to cross a border in order to become a refugee. And it wasn't until the 1960s that any other than a European could be a refugee. It was defined in law that a refugee was European, and it's only recently that we've started to change that mechanism to say other people from other places other than the war zone of Europe can be called refugees. So there are in fact 3.5 million refugees that have come out of Syria, and they're in many places of the world, in particular in Turkey. I said that most of us don't have comprehensive or single sentence answers, but there are a few politicians that seem to have answers. And one of them is a president who has assumed power in the United States named Donald Trump. I just take a quote from 2015 where he said, "I will build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me. And I'll build them very inexpensively." And he's probably being truthful about that. I want to break through some of the illusions that we have about this process. Actually, walls are not that expensive to build. It's not the wall which will cost the money. It's the administration of the border security, and I'll come back to that as I move through the talk. It's not the walls that cost money. What's happening around the world is there are a number of politicians who think the walls are the answer, and currently 70 countries across the world are building walls at the moment alongside Donald Trump's idea of building a wall. But the United States has been building a wall for 20 years. It's built a third of the wall already. That wall is actually not actually the problem. Where the wall is, less people die. Where the wall is not, and they made a conscious decision about this, they did not build a wall across the most dangerous desert zones because they thought across that area, and it's the Rio Grande area and into parts of the east, they left no wall built. And that's the part where most people die. Another politician, and I come from Australia and I offer my apologies to you as an Australian. We are, if anything, worse than the United States in the way in which we handle refugees. We have a straightforward policy, which is a positive one. We take more refugees almost than any country in the world as settlement refugees. They come through formal processes and they travel by aeroplane. They're welcome, they come in and they live in a reasonable way as citizens of Australia. But if you choose to travel by boat, for some reason, you are reviled. The ex-Prime Minister of the country of Australia, who lost his position to what has seemed like a more humanitarian Prime Minister, but in fact turned out to be no different. And he has, after the death of Ayaan Kurdi and his brother and his mother and all those people who died on boats in trying to get to Europe, he said, if you want to stop the drownings, stop the boats. That is his argument. So we have two arguments: build a wall, stop the boats, and deny them any resources. Well, I think it's more complex than that, and we have to work our way steadily through talking about what the situation is in order to make some claims about what's happening. Walls are being built, and those borders are being militarized. Now, that's a simple statement, but when I say that borders are being militarized, you think it has been forever? It's simply not. We're only talking the last 100 years where borders began to be monitored in the way they are currently monitored. Passports are a relatively recent thing, but the borders being militarized is a very recent thing. And the militarization of the Mexican-US border was militarized really across the period of the 1990s. Now, one of those things about the militarization of borders is that people die crossing, and 6,336 people have died crossing the US-Mexican border from 1998 to 2014. And we don't know, really, because they are people who are not documented, and therefore many of them disappear in the desert. What is estimated is probably that twice that number die, and we don't even know they've died because they're taken by animals, their bones are lost. In the same period, and we're talking now 2000 to about 2015, 1,974 people died on boats coming to Australia. Now, those figures, and you just have to hold those in your head. Donald Trump, maniac that he is, person who I cannot understand how he's going to make a difference in the world other than badly, he has not been involved in any of that process. It's actually prior to his coming, and he's exacerbating and naming a process which we have been involved with for the last couple of decades. In 2010, President Barack Obama signed the Southwest Border Security Act into law, which meant that approximately 600 additional million went in. But that wasn't the key thing. The key thing, he sent 1,200 National Guards down there. National Guards are the name for the military. He was militarizing the border. He was extending the border rule, and people died during the period. And last year, 300 or so people died in the same way, 322 deaths on the southeast-west border, in the same way that 300 people died the year before. In 2016, $3.6 billion was spent on that border alone. Now, I'll come back to that again, but this is the situation. Now, let's take it broader and go from the United States to a crisis of humanity, because that's what this conference is talking about. It's a crisis which has multiple consequences. The first one is systematic deaths are caused in the name of border security. So to secure ourselves, we are comfortable, relatively comfortable, although we occasionally read the newspaper, people are dying, we are relatively comfortable to say that we'll protect ourselves by allowing people to die. And the figures I mentioned, and this is from Frontex. And Frontex is the official agency, the European Border and Coast Guard Agency. One out of four people died on their way to Europe coming by boat. The second thing that happens is people in need are re-identified. It used to be that people in need were refugees. They were people who were brought in, they were photographed by the various agencies, they were splashed across papers, their faces were seen, their faces were obvious, and we knew them as people in need. Now they are treated as hordes as flows, as invasions. They're treated not as people, but as things, and they're starting to be treated in such a way that we are relabeling them as our security threat. So I've put there the poem by Kafafi, and it's a poem from the late part of the 19th century called Waiting for the Barbarians. And that poem, which is worth having a look at, and I won't have time to read from, is a poem where barbarians were waited for because they were the other which were necessary to us. We actually treated people who are others as connected to who we are, and while we felt ourselves threatened by them, we didn't treat them as such others that they were invisible people, that they were the hordes that were coming, and they were represented in the film as the clambering masses. We treated them as people who made a difference to us, even if we feared them. That's the point of reconciliation. That's the point of hospitality. It's not that you have to love your neighbour in that romantic sense that we now have in the modern sense of love. Love your neighbour was a sense of relationship and engagement where sometimes you even feared your neighbour. But to bring that person in, so it brings us to the third point. Humanitarian support is now reduced to crisis management. Humanitarian support, and the word humanitarian has been completely degraded as a term. When we say humanitarian now, we think of sending the bombers in and bombing from a great height in Libya or in Syria. And now the word humanitarian has been lost to us. We can't even work with a term which is sacred as that, and it turns against itself. Older ideas of ethics are therefore pushed aside. And I think of the ethics of the Good Samaritan, where it was an ethic where you crossed the road to the other side to help someone. Now we've actually reached the point, and this is, I don't know how we got there, where not only don't we cross the road to the other side to get to help someone, as soon as they cross the road, they are reviled by needing our support and our help. And we find ourselves in a situation where once those in need get turned into pseudo-terrorists and reviled creatures, the barbarians, and therefore we have come to blame the victim of a structural situation where those structures are quite profound. They are produced by us, those structures. They are the structures of climate change, which are producing climate refugees. They are the structures of rapacious capitalism, which are producing landless people who are leaving the places where they were because they cannot afford to be there anymore. They are the sufferers of what is called transnational globalized violence, transnational local globalized violence, and they're people who are suffering from wars that we were part of, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, or alternatively, wars that have been going on for 30 years, 40 years. Afghanistan has been going on through a whole series of cycles, but the Congo is being another one, which are the outcomes of the difficulties of how we as Europeans settled the country. If I'd started this talk properly in Australia, I would have started with what's called an acknowledgement to country. And the acknowledgement to country is an acknowledgement to Indigenous people. It's an acknowledgement which says, I acknowledge that we live on land which is held in custody by others. It's held in custody by those people who are connected to us, but other. They were the people who are original. And so I would say, I acknowledge those people, elders past and present, who are here in this room or in other parts of the state, and I acknowledge that we are standing on Indigenous land. But what we see ourselves now is finding ourselves is saying, those people are just another layer of the movement of the displaced persons of the world. And so that crisis of displacement goes deep, and it goes deep into the 19th century and back, in the case of the United States, it goes back into the period of the Great Revolution, where settlement was also displacement. It was internal displacement, and it caused chaos and problems for people. Now, we are part of the making of the world, which is producing those very people. As we move through this, then, this crisis of mobility is one dimension of that. Now, just a few facts just to get us through. 65.3 million people are currently displaced in the world today. That's the UNHCR figures. Syrians in Hungary and Austria, 2 million in Turkey, Africans drowning off the coast of Italy, Greece and Turkey, and then the Rohingya. Now, The Rohingya is a really complicated issue because it's in the Burma area, but it's also connected to India. And I am one of the directors of Global Reconciliation, and one of our patrons is Aung San Suu Kyi. And as she is having to deny at the moment that the Rohingya are being, or they're being massacred, they're being pushed out, they're being killed. But she's denying that because she's under such pressure from a military government, and what she's been trying to do is push against them in private. So what we find ourselves now is that even on those basic things like the Rohingya, who may have come to Burma 100 years ago as refugees, who may be Islamic and don't fit into the dominant Buddhist culture, but are being treated as outsiders, and that we are not. Even the patron of Global Reconciliation, the organization I work for, cannot say what is the truth and what is happening about this. I also have to distinguish people who are displaced from people who are migrants, people who choose to move. These migrants, in the 1990s, it was 2 million. The 2000s, it became over 4 million, and the 2010s, still around that 4 million mark per annum. And in places like the United States, if you think that you have a lot of refugees in your community, the figures are 100,000 immigrants per year at 2.45 per 100,000 people. My own country, Australia, which I think is the most shamed place in the world in the way in which it treats immigrants and refugees, takes more immigrants per population than the US and takes more refugees per population than the US. Twice as many migrants. And if you went to Lebanon, it's not twice as many, it's 40 times as many. If you go to Turkey now, we're talking in figures where refugee camps have become cities. If you go to Lebanon, the largest group at the moment of refugees, apart from the latest round, are those living in settlements that have been in those settlements for 2-3 generations. I was in a refugee camp in Lebanon, just south of the main capital city, and we had to go in an ambulance in order not to be shot. And in going, and I'm talking 2 years ago, and to go into that refugee camp is to see young boys whose lives are now caught up in the tensions between rival gangs within those refugee settlements, where 3 generations after their expulsion from Israel, they find themselves still living in refugee camps. Refugee camps are becoming a way of life around the world. So this kind of thing leads us to talk about what should we do rather than just leaving it like that. We should begin with principles that begin both with the local and the global. That is an ethics of right and an ethics of care. The ethics of rights, unfortunately, have let us down. In some ways, we have more rights than ever before, but they are now nationally bound in most of their presumptions. So an ethics of care is required, which underlies an ethics of rights. It is the right of any person who is stateless, who has left their home, it is the right of any person to be received as a non-illegal person if they cross a national boundary and they are in fear in any way for their person. It's a very limited definition. It requires them to be in fear. The word fear is the center of what the definition is, and the crossing of a national border. It's still the current definition. But we do not even allow that to happen. In Australia, the way in which they stop the boats is by turning them back at sea, even though those boats are rickety, falling apart, and could sink. Alternatively, if the boat looks like it doesn't have a chance of getting anywhere and definitely will sink, and that's a judgment made by the particular people in the Navy, which is an invidious judgment they have to make, they then take them to Christmas Island, Nauru, or one of the offshore processing centres. We've got to the point now in Australia where we have defined our national boundaries to cut off sections of our nation territory so that they cannot be treated as if a refugee has arrived in Australia. So parts of Australia are, for the purposes of the entry of the refugee, treated as not Australia. That's how we get around it. And so when they arrive at this place, which is Australia for all purposes except for being a refugee, they get processed and they sent to a foreign country. They will get sent to a place like Papua New Guinea, Nauru. They get sent to places where they cannot arrive in Australia. And if they go to those places, They are interned currently forever. No Australian will allow a refugee who comes by boat to come to Australia. If they come by plane, that's fine. But if they come by boat. Now, here's the really, this is a structural thing. Our principles have to be in ethics of care because things have changed. I've got their forms of global mobility. Embodied mobility is what we're talking about. The whole of the talk has been about the embodied mobility of persons moving across boundaries. But agents are able to move. They, as long as you have a passport, the agents of mobility include people who work for corporations, people who work for the state. Objects are allowed to move. In fact, there's a whole range of institutions available to us where we spend our time talking about how objects should move around the world. We have to say, let the commodity run free because somehow it has rights too. It has rights which somehow go beyond the bodies. And disembodied relations, that is the movements of capital and culture and symbolism and things which are related to the internet, they run across the globe in ways that are relatively unfettered, including the movement of financial capital in particular. Now, all those things lead you to talk about an ethics of care being much more grounded, and therefore we're going to have to talk about some structural things, and I'm going to try and do that to finish. So instead of just a rhetoric of care, which the Australian government has, by the way, they sound nothing like your president. They sound like they're civilised people. We are trying to stop the boats because all those people are dying. And if we don't show by the current regime of interning those people for the term of their natural life, unless we can find an agreement with the United States to send some to Latin America, unless we can do that, we're allowing people to die. So our solution to stop people dying is stopping the boats. Let's move to the last consideration. We need to move to a structure which seems beyond us at the moment, which is to move to a global national structure, which requires people to think about refugees as one of the crises of this world. Now, at the moment, UNHRC has 2% of its funding from the United Nations. It is struggling. It depends upon a number of nation states giving it money. But we're talking about the institution in the world which manages the way in which refugees are considered, including the statistics about them. And it has not enough funding to do what it does. We're at the point, and I described the billions that are being spent on border security. More is spent on border security than spent on the CIA, about 8-1. More is spent on border security than spent on the FBI. Border security has become one of the major costs to the nation, and yet, apart from wars and the extensions of the military overseas, and yet we find ourselves unable to support a basic institution which could manage this process. What I'm advocating, therefore, and this sounds a bit harsh when I say it and a bit difficult, but what it requires is actually a global compact where nations sign on to what might be called a United Nations, and they agree that there's a problem. And agreeing that there's a problem, they stop doing unilateral deals, like our Prime Minister coming to talk to your President, and they have a multilateral discussion about the levels of immigration in the world today and the level of refugees. And they set up a processing, institutionalized processing method. And by setting up such a method, it would require every nation state to work out what they're capable of taking. That is, according to their capacity to take. There is no reason why Lebanon or Jordan or Turkey should be taking millions and millions of refugees when we in the richer parts of the world are taking such small numbers. But that's not to break down borders. What I'm arguing, therefore, is we manage borders, and for all those refugees who want to come to a particular place, they want to come to Berlin because they're very generous and open in Berlin, they want to go to Stockholm because that's a wonderful place to be a refugee, and they don't want to go somewhere else, what we set up is a condition by which a processing occurs across the world to manage crises. And in managing those crises, it would work from the global downwards. It would have a national framework which said how many refugees each nation was taking, and then in moving into a local framework, it would start working with all cities and towns to say, how would you support refugees in your town? How would you support refugees in your city? What resources would you need? What psychologists would you need? What doctors would you need? How can we manage a major crisis? What I'm going to finish with is, in fact, from a novel, and it's by a Mexican, Yuri Herrera. It's called Signs Preceding the End of the World. We need to manage the crisis, but what we also need to do is stop treating people as barbarians. And this is really the key thing about his entire novel that he writes. He ends this book, and it's with a woman called Makina, and he ends this book with her being held by a police officer who claims that she's a person who's come from Mexico illegally, and indeed she has. She's been looking for her son. And she finds her son. In fact, he's gone into the US military in replacement for somebody else's son, and therefore he's being paid as a proxy to go overseas, and so their son will not be killed. But he says, write down where you're from, and write down, the police officer says to McKinas. And she wrote without stopping to think which word was better, and she wrote fast. And she writes, we are to blame for this destruction. We who don't speak your tongue and don't know how to keep quiet either. We who didn't come by boat, who dirty up your doorsteps with our dust, who break your barbed wire. We who came to take your jobs, who dream of wiping your shit, who long for work all hours. We who fill your shiny, clean streets with the smell of food, who brought you violence you've never known, who deliver your dope, who deserve to be chained by neck and feet. We who are happy to die for you, what else could we do? We, the ones who are waiting for who knows what. We, the dark, the short, the greasy, the shifty, the fat, the anemic. We, the barbarians. That's what the world has come to, that people in need now think of themselves as barbarians. Thank you.
So I'd like to start the conversation, and then we will definitely open it up for a conversation for everyone. I'm struck by the fact that we're both products of immigrant nations, and your talk was depressing in the sense of feeling like that we are not doing any, in fact, we're adding so much pain to the world in the way we, sons and daughters of an immigrant nation, are dealing with that. I was struck also by the embodied and disembodied, and specifically wondering of the link between those. It feels like so much of the disembodied comes from cultures like this one. And where do you see a link between those, sort of an increase? It feels like an increase in the disembodied should result in an increase in the embodied acceptance, but in fact it feels like it's the opposite. Can you talk a little bit about
that? Yes, I can. It's a really crucial point. And the point that I was arguing was that there's an inverse relation. The more disembodied the relation, the more we are comfortable with the movement across national borders. Even to the point where terms like freedom are being attached to the idea of the freedom of currencies or free trade agreements or those sorts of things. And yet at the same time, we won't allow the movement of people. We allow movement of people as long as it's administered. And across the course of this century, bodies have become more administered than ever before, and administered in more and more rigorous and difficult ways than ever before. Now, the consequences of that are interesting. Now, globalization, which really what's that tracking is the form of globalization. Where does power reside in that relationship? Disembodied relations are what give you power. Embodied relations are no longer the basis. It's not that Donald Trump is a great orator who could stand before a community. It's that the television cameras were on him as he stood before his communities. It's not that he says something which has a consequence because he's talked to lots of people. It's because when he tweets, there are millions involved, and when he writes an edict, it is then carried out by agents of that process. And so the complication to what we're describing is once the world was made up of power, which was much more embodied, even the word state, which is an interesting term, the word state came from the word standing, to stand, the standing of the prince, the body of the prince. And now we now have a state where the state is based on the agents of extension, and it's really the disembodied power that works. So whether or not the wall gets built, and I'll say this very directly, Barack Obama was building electronic wall. He was building a wall which was about administration. That doesn't make it any less worse than the wall that was being built by Donald Trump. And that's the complication we face. And I think it's a very real concern, because if we are to think about nation states as having boundaries, and I think we should, and they should be boundaries which are administered, we have to think again about the layers, as I was describing, between the global and the local, and about how communities link into a global ethic of support. It doesn't mean that this community has to take a million, or Berlin, which took 100,000 refugees last year and managed them, built houses for them. It doesn't mean that it has to be every community taking lots. It just means that we have to know this is a global issue.
Okay, we will open up for questions from the audience.
Thank you very much. My name is Lawal from Lagos State University, Nigeria. When we are discussing about refugee, I think it comes with solemn responsibility. And we need to differentiate between whether refugee is actually something that has to do with humanitarian crisis or whether it has to do with legal crisis. It is when we discuss at a village square like this, that is when we talk about humanitarian issues. But for policymakers, what they see about refugee is actually issue of legality. So most political leaders, policymakers, they hide behind the legal implication of admitting refugees. That is one point. I think what we should do here is to try as much as possible to look at principles surrounding the admission of refugees. For instance, in your discussion, I was expecting you to put some light on principle like the principle of non-refoulement. That is the principle of non-refoulement, which forbids that refugees should not be turned back when they come to your country. I think by the time we speak to principles, by the time we talk about legality, then we would be able to prevent the sending back of refugees to where they come from. So I just want you to throw some light on the legal aspect of refugee more than the humanitarian aspect, because I think the solution of refugee will come with advocacy. Thank you very much.
It's a fabulous question, thank you. I mentioned it in one sentence, and what I said in that one sentence was that the more the issue is caused crisis, the more that rights are unable to deal with it. So to use the example I used from Lebanon, the right of return, which would be a right which you would think of as a natural right for a refugee, is not a right that is being assailed by Lebanon, but neither is it being granted by Israel. We are in a situation now where the legal requirements have changed so dramatically that states are using mechanisms to get around those legal requirements. Lebanon doesn't return refugees. It makes them non-citizens, invisible people. And those people then set up what I described as cities of refugees, cities of people who have been there for three generations. And those cities of generations are carrying on, and it's not just Lebanon. It's in Jordan, and it's in a number of places across the Middle East, into Africa, and into Southeast Asia, particularly in places like Indonesia at the moment, where Indonesia is a traffic point for lots of refugees who are coming through. I absolutely agree with you about those rights, questions of legality, but the reasons that they don't work is because they treat it as a singular dimensional thing, which requires people simply to meet that as a technical requirement. Unless you add the two together, and I think this is what you're saying, if you add the two together, then you're actually starting to deal with the problem. Because we're not talking about the end of borders, and we're not talking about the end of legal requirements on refugees. But I'll just take through one other setting. That is, most refugees now get rid of their documents, because it's actually better not to be in the place of having a documented past. you better not be in that situation, because if you're in that situation, then you can be rejected more easily. It takes a longer time for an assessment process. And so, unfortunately, from both sides, both from the top, a legal nicety about what it means to return, and from bottom, about where they should return to or who they in fact are, those two things mean that you need to have the ethics of care holding it together.
I could follow up on that question just on the legal basis in general, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert in this area at all, that even opening up some of the legal questions at this point, given the political situation, the discussions about refugees and migrants, it's too dangerous to even open it up, even though we all feel that there should be an expanded definition. But if we did that, we would probably lose ground as opposed to gain ground.
I think that's exactly right. One of the things about the history of the word refugee, obviously it has a long-term cultural history from the Huguenots and from the history of Europe and movement of peoples and so on. However, the term refugee goes into law in 1945 with the United Nations. And when it goes into law, international law that is, which is already vague and already depends upon our compliance voluntarism, that refugee law defined a refugee in four or five ways, which meant that you very hard to be a refugee. You had to be leaving the European war zone. You had to be European. You had to have crossed a national border. And you have to be in fear of your body for violence. Now, many refugees are leaving sub-Saharan Africa because their families are dying of starvation, or they're leaving places in Syria where disruption was multiple in general, and they find it very hard to prove that there's a distinct relation. In a place like Sri Lanka, which is a very interesting one, where the war has ended 10 years ago, or a bit less than that, that war, immediately the war ended, the civil war between the Tamil Tigers and the government of Sri Lanka, once that ended, it was said that those people were safe. And yet, we know that dozens and hundreds of people disappeared in the aftermath of the war being finished. So those complications mean one side of it becomes very difficult because it's already a contested definition.
Right.
But the further definition becomes, well, it means that those 60-odd million people who are displaced could become refugees and therefore legitimately able to claim asylum anywhere in the world. And that's what most nation states don't want.
My name is Ryan, and I'm here with the School of Policy and International Affairs from the University of Maine. I'm just wondering, do you truly believe that domestic political leaders will ever sacrifice their own domestic self-interest in order to combat a global cause if it doesn't serve them domestically or serve their political clout at home?
That's a fabulous and difficult question because the evidence at the moment is no. The evidence is that most states are actually closing their borders in a much more rigorous way. In a very interesting way, however, and I think Germany is one of those interesting ones where Angela Merkel, for a period, until she got so assailed by her own constituencies, and she's a conservative, she got assailed by her own constituents and found that she couldn't sustain the level of immigration. But in part that was because it was a singular nation state which was taking an enormous number of refugees, as were many of the Scandinavian countries. What interestingly is happening, and I think it's happening from below rather than from the national level, is that city leaders are starting to stand up and talk in a way that national leaders were not. Now maybe that doesn't have the consequences. You would think it doesn't have, those people won't come and therefore it doesn't matter. But, and I use the city of Berlin as an example, they had an airport, and it's a beautiful metaphor for the complexity of this. The airport was Tempelhof, it was Hitler's airport. It's an extraordinary imposing structure, a kilometer long circular building, which is now a place where kids fly kites and people play in the grass and on the tarmac. They won't change any of the tarmac, they won't shift any of the heritage values. They turned that over to the refugees as a first stage. And then they changed laws in their city about how they built buildings to make it possible to house 100,000 people. I think there are many cities across Europe that have been doing that, and they're doing it against national policy.
There was a question here. Yep.
My name's Joshua. I live in Augusta, Maine. I guess, how do you expect to get your message to, we here are a small percentage of this country. We're the more educated, the more wealthy, and the larger majority of the country might be less wealthy, less educated, and probably more likely to scorn your message. How do you expect to get that message to more than the small percentage of people here hearing you tonight?
Thank you. Because I think the crisis is so great, and as time, and maybe I'm being naive, the recognition that those simplistic things like stop the boats or build the wall have actually made no difference at all to the problem. In fact, have exacerbated it. And what we're seeing, despite the building of walls, and I mentioned 70 countries are now building walls, some very famous ones, like Israel will say that it's had no terrorist bombs since it built the wall. And yet, Israel is more insecure now than it's ever been. The state of Mexico is building a southern wall, even as the United States wanted to build a northern wall. The ironies abound, of course, because, and I don't know if you know this, but Mexicans came across the border. The net movement of Mexicans across the border into the United States in 2016 was negative. That is, more Mexicans went back to Mexico than came to the United States. The people crossing the border are actually people from further south, from some of the Latin American countries which are feeling the pressure. Now, as the crisis is real and consequential and structural and is occurring from places where we have been involved in wars or other forms of activity, that means that we have a responsibility to it. And if at the moment our policies don't work, I think the disgruntledness of people, the people who voted for Donald Trump or voted in Australia for the Liberal Party, as it's called in Australia. Our Liberals are our Conservatives, you'll love that. The Liberal Party are the ones who are most vociferous about this particular stop the boats message, although the Labor Party follows through and makes it a dual party presidency. They will find that their constituents, because they're disgruntled with establishment politics, because they're not taking those one sentence messages anymore, except under moments of duress and periods of, they will start to question it. And they might, for the first stage, look to another charismatic leader, another maniac,
person. We love that term.
Another person who's dangerous. But that kind of movement cannot go on without end, because what it causes is more disruption across the world. And this is a world that's currently in crisis in a comprehensive way. And if we don't respond to it from the community upwards, then I think we're in trouble. And I think those people, as they find that it wasn't migrants and refugees that were taking their jobs are changing because of the nature of a structural change in the economy towards a service sector on the one hand and automation on the other. It is very straightforward, empirically true, and 4 years of Donald Trump will not change that. And if those people are still feeling Donald Trump at the end has served them well, I'd be very surprised.
We've got a question from one of our remote locations. I think it will show up on the board. Could you address the underlying causes of the refugee flows? How do we change national and local mindsets to accommodate refugees? From James in Rockland.
Two very big questions. So first, the underlying causes of refugees. They're utterly comprehensive. I can take you through what they mean, but let me say, every time you want to talk about anything, it's got an economic dimension, it's got an ecological dimension, a political dimension, and a cultural dimension. And if you can put those four dimensions of social life into the framework of your description of anything, you'll find that it helps the understanding. First, if I do the political reason, and that's probably the strongest one in this instance in terms of refugees and asylum seekers. They are refugees from political places which have got violence of a kind which is not just pushing people out with fear, but physically displacing them. Syria is now bombed, as Baghdad was bombed, as Kabul was bombed, and the Syrians are leaving for fear of their lives. So politically, and it's not just a singular regime which is the problem, it's actually a comprehensive sense of our only way of handling this is to go in with bombers from a great height, rather than thinking about how we deal with difficult situations of regime change, of discussions of needs of people, of all the issues to do with how we deal with different cultural groupings, including Islamic peoples. And I mean a particular kind of Islamic people, like the Taliban or the ISIS groups. Politically, it's massive. Economically, it's critical. A greater number of refugees are now moving because they have a sense of their life as not being viable. It's not necessarily starving. It's actually because many of the people who are moving, particularly into the European theatre, are young men. It's also because they want a different world. It's young families who are moving. It's people who are trying to look ahead and say, economically, the place we're in is not viable. Ecologically, it's an issue because what we're seeing is what can't be called yet climate refugees, although there are climate refugees, particularly from Pacific Islands, but from Africa in particular, or from some parts of Southeast Asia, the climate is changing in such disruptive ways that people don't find that they have a stable enough ecology to build their lives with enough food to eat. And then culturally, if we go back to the culture of the first great migrations of the 19th century, they're often built on a hope of staying the same, of leaving somewhere to take your life somewhere else, to rebuild it exactly as you had it. That's all changed. What's happening now is people are culturally looking for a place for minimal security. They're looking for a place which holds aspirations to be different. They're looking for places where they can go and feel that they're children. They're willing to sacrifice their own lives, their own sense of work, in order that their children are well off culturally and that they can go to school. So I think we're seeing a comprehensive process. And the second part of that question, I've lost.
Yeah, we'll go over here to next question.
Thank you very much.
Stand up, your name and hometown.
I'm Bruce DeGrace from Rockland, Maine. Thank you very much for your presentation. In the last few weeks in the United States, we've seen quite a political movement in support of migrants, refugees. Is this of just passing significance because of the current political situation in the American administration? Or is there something we can learn from this? Is there something, are there deeper significant messages from this?
Yes. We face a crisis of refugees in the same way we face the Depression. And the photograph I showed as one of the photographs in my talk was of an internally displaced person who was a refugee during the period of the Depression. That photograph became very famous. The face of that person became Dorothea Lange's photography and so on, became a catch cry for people to think, these are people that we're dealing with and the comprehensiveness of this is problematic. And a new deal came in as part of the rethinking of that entire process. I think that we're seeing a change because it's now coming to people's attention very directly, very precisely in your face. And I think it's a politics which will carry forward. I don't think that it's that different from the kinds of insecurity of some of the people that voted for the very person that caused the current crisis of the legal implications of how people come from various countries to the United States. People are feeling disillusioned and feeling, it's called a legitimation crisis in the academic literature. And this legitimation crisis means that people are looking for answers. And for a period, they'll go for single answer, single sentence answers and the simplicity. But I think the two sides of the same coin, and I mean that in a very strong sense, are that people in communities like this and communities across the United States have been recognizing the complexity of this in ways that perhaps didn't come through in the election.
We have a question here, and then we have a remote question. So let's go here, because they've been waiting for a while, and then we'll go to one of our remote locations.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Drury. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner in the Rockport area. And I deal with clients that have a lot of trauma. And oftentimes, people that have been victimized feel like they've deserved the trauma or they've caused the trauma. And it's so interesting that the people that have been in resettled, they've been displaced, they're almost re-traumatized by thinking that they're barbarians. So how do you address this complex sense of re-traumatization with these people? Are there efforts being made to somehow convince them that they didn't cause this, that you know, that they're not welcome in many areas, and what kind of a sense of rejection and failure these people must have.
In the 1950s and 1960s, both in the United States and in Australia, refugees were actually publicly welcomed. They were drawn into communities. In the first instance, and I include migrants in this process, but refugees in particular, after a period immediately after the Second World War, and you will know this as well, that most people moved after the Second World War, not during the Second World War. And in fact, it was part of that trauma. What they felt was there was no hope where they were. It wasn't simply that they were beset by guns or they wanted a new economic life. They weren't trying to get what a certain House of Representatives person would call the benefits of being an American citizen. They were simply people who were traumatized and felt they needed to be somewhere else because the trauma was carried by the place that they came from. I think the only way to handle that is multiple. I think it's a mixture of professional support, but it's also community engagement with those people. Interestingly, and I'll use Australia as an example, and this I think is it's very similar to the United States. There are layers. There are cleavages. There are contradictions. A government does not necessarily represent the majority of the people in its views. In Australia, the government which rejects those people that come by boat is responding to about 20% of the population who live in semi-provincial or rural districts, which are swinging seats, which make the difference to how or not they're voted in. Now, those same places, when they meet people, are actually gracious, welcoming people. They're not stupid or ugly or deplorables even. They're actually people who are trying to make their own way in the world and are insecure, often very insecure about global processes. What you bring together in those two settings is traumatized people and those that even have stayed in place and are feeling themselves to be under threat. And in Australia, there are a lot of small country towns that actually said, we will take refugees. And in those country towns, they had welcoming ceremonniesthey had people take their children to school, they supported them through the early stages, they employed psychologists to help with them. Now, that's not easy. None of that's easy. One of the things about traumatized people is they both can blame themselves, but they can also be ugly too. And there's no reason why a traumatized person is any nicer than you or I. So it takes a town to support a refugee like it takes a town to
raise a child. Let's go to the remote location. We've got a question coming in. How do we reverse the negative stigma of the word refugee? Ayub Muhammad from Portland.
I actually don't know the answer to that question because the word refugee went through across the 90s into the 2000s. It stayed as a relatively positive word for the most part at every place in the world that I know of, except the United States. So one of the things is it's not a major problem in the rest of the world. Refugees, the word, and here, asylum seeker became the legal word to name, because refugee was such a positive word, in Australia it had to be changed to asylum seeker to say that they weren't automatically granted rights. Because asylum seeker is still someone who's still seeking something. And so we describe them as illegals who are seeking asylum. The other term, and there are three terms in this mix, the other term is migrant.
I started working, I worked
and migrant has moved between a good word and a bad word as well. But we know about migrants around the world and the concern was
entrepreneurial,
just seeing
active,
the process
engaged,
of urbanization
and so
massive changes.
The word migrant is also changing.
So that was part of it.
One of the things about words is that
in Australia, everybody's in
their meaning, and I'm not sure how we change the word.
I've never really focused on my immigrant status, but and it's so taken for granted. I have a Welsh immigrant background, which meant that my family were carpenters, and they were carpenters who came to Australia in the 1830s. So they've lived in Australia, and yet in Australia, and I think it's part of the reason why we don't have the kinds of cultural conflict, everybody considers themselves an immigrant. And I think the biggest problem about Australia is they also consider Aboriginal people immigrants, where that is, they have no more rights than the rest
of
us.
They arrive by airplane?
No, they arrive by boat.
What?
Yes, and so they're treated as somehow just very much earlier than us. Mm-hmm. But I think that Australia was the place in which Aboriginal people became human. though it's a place where they culturally became the people that they are. Mm. It's very different to arrive as a second people. Mm. And there's a kind of disruption that's involved in being an immigrant, which is good, but I also think a sense of place is important. So I like the idea of the dialectic between a strong sense of place, and when I grew up in the city of Melbourne, the one that I've just criticised to you so roundly, I grew up in the city of Melbourne, and when I was 20, I said, I'm never going to leave this city for a job, which was part of that Australianist sense that everybody could be so easily globalised these days that we should stay in one place.
Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you all for participating tonight.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. This week, we are featuring talks from the 2017 Camden Conference, Refugees and Global Migration, Humanity's Crisis, featuring speakers exploring the varied causes of the current international humanitarian crisis and the challenges that come with accepting immigrants from particular countries, regions, and demographic groups. All of the 2017 Camden Conference talks and panel discussions are archived on their website, camdenconference.org. Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast at mainepublic.org. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.